Last week, we started in Numbers chapter 31 and worked our way into 32 for a space. In 31, the 12,000 warriors had returned from the war against the Midianites. They were sent by God to punish the Midianites for leading Israel into sin with the Moabites and the Midianites. Israel's camped up on the plains near Moab. And they returned with spoils, including women and children. Moses was angry when they came back. And he said, hey, they were part of the sin caused by plotting of the women of the Midianites. And so the direction every male and every non-virgin female was to be put to death, which they did. Eleazar directed the cleansing of the soldiers and the spoils following that correction. Every soldier that killed or touched a dead person had to stay outside the camp for 7 days. That was right in line with the rules that were given earlier for people that came in contact with dead animals or people. And then so for during that 7 days, on the third day they would do some cleansing washing, and on the seventh day they would cleanse themselves and their clothing, and then they were free to come back into the camp. They also were to cleanse the spoils for the non-flammables, things that wouldn't burn. They used both fire and water, but for the things that would burn, they just used the water, and then they could bring it all into the camp. Now, God directed Yahweh through Moses some division of the spoils. Half of what they brought back went to the soldiers, and the other half went to the congregation as a whole. What went to the soldiers was taxed at 0.2%, if you want to look at it that way, 1 in 500. And that offering went to Eleazar as an offering to Yahweh. The what went to the congregation was taxed at 2%, and that went to the Levites in their use of caring for the tabernacle. The spoils they brought back were huge. If you just added up all the animals, they brought back 808,000 animals for their livestock. That's a lot. Of course, they were a big group of people at that point. And the officers did a census of the soldiers, the 12,000 that went to fight, and found out there was not one casualty. So they came with an offering that they presented as an atonement, giving it to God on behalf of sparing their lives during that time of war with the Midianites. And they had collected gold, jewelry, and things as they went about the war, and that was 6,750 shekels. That's 419 pounds. And this wouldn't mean at all the same thing in that day, but it's just interesting to me. I added it up, told you then, tell you again today. That would be about $24.5 billion worth of gold today. So they brought back, they took that gold that they got and they gave that as an offering to God, which was accepted as an atonement, not in the sense for sin, but in that God protected them and they, none of them lost their lives. As we went into Numbers 32, we saw Reuben and Gad, the tribes, make a formal proposal to Moses. It was a pretty simple proposal. We have lots of livestock and we like this Amorite area. It's good for livestock. We want to stay here and not cross the Jordan. And Moses didn't appreciate that one little bit. He said, you're just like your fathers 40 years ago. You're this action would discourage the tribes. And so now the other tribes wouldn't be as likely to go. And we could find ourselves right back where we were 40 years ago, where God pronounced judgment for our lack of faith, and nobody got to go into the promised land, and we had to wander for 40 years until that generation passed, and Moses was most unhappy with them. So the leaders of the Gad and Reuben tribes returned, and they adjusted their request. Well, let us settle here, but at the time of war, when the Jordan is crossed, all of our soldiers will go into the promised land and we will fight until everything is done and all the land is won and all of the people have been put out of the promised land. And so Moses says, okay, if you'll do what you said before God, he put that in there. This is a pledge then before Yahweh, okay. And so they make a deal that they will go. And Moses said, if you don't, you'll be sinning against God, and be sure your sin will find you out. And that's where we stopped, which puts us ready. There's just a little bit more to that story that we didn't find the time for last time. So we're at the end of chapter 32, or near it. We're going to start in verse 28 and read through 42. So that's where we are in chapter 32, beginning in 28. And this is what it says. So God commanded concerning them. Let me just start over and put all the words in. So Moses gave command concerning them. This is the two tribes. To Eleazar the priest, and to Joshua the son of Nun, and to the heads of the fathers' households of the tribes of the sons of Israel. I either put extra or take some out. Moses said to them, if the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, everyone who is armed for battle, will cross with you over the Jordan in the presence of the Lord, and the land is subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead for a possession. But if they will not cross over with you armed, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. The sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben answered, saying, as the Lord has said to your servants, so we will do. We ourselves will cross over armed in the presence of the Lord into the land of Canaan, and the possession of our inheritance shall remain with us across the Jordan. So Moses gave to them, to the sons of Gad and to the sons of Reuben, and to the half-tribe of Joseph's son Manasseh, the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, the king of Bashan, the land with its cities, with their territories, the cities of the surrounding land. The sons of Gad built Dibon and Ataroth and Aroer and Atroth Shaphan and Jazer and Jogbaha and Beth Nimrah and Beth Haran as fortified cities and sheepfolds for sheep. The sons of Reuben built Heshbon and Eliah and Kirithaim and Nebo and Baal-Meon, their names being changed, and Sibmah, and gave other names to the cities which they built. The sons of Micher, the son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and took it, and dispossessed the Amorites who were in it. So Moses gave Gilead to Michar, the son of Manasseh, and he lived in it. Jair, the son of Manasseh, went and took its towns, and called them Havoth-Jair. Noboth went and took Kenoth and its villages, and called it Noboth after his own name. So, looking at what we just read, what we see is that Moses passes this on to Eleazar and to Joshua and to the heads of the tribes of Israel. Why did he include Joshua in that? Easy question, maybe. Why did Joshua get involved?
He'd taken over Moses' position.
God had designated Joshua as to be the follower of Moses in the role of leading the people. Moses had asked for God to name a leader, and he had been named. And Moses already knows that this transition isn't far away, that he himself is at the end of his life. And the deal is, if Gad and Reuben tribe send the men armed for battle across the Jordan and do everything they said, that this land would be subdued. They're doing this in the presence of Jehovah, Yahweh. It is a promise in front of him, including him, and they can have the land of Gilead as a possession. We could talk more about, maybe we will, this map later, but basically you can see all of these items on the east of the Jordan in that map I handed out. And that's where we're talking about. It's not in the promised land. It's next to the promised land, so to speak. We'll get more into that, depending on how far we get today into the next chapter. But apparently there were still some of the folks there from the Amorites, but mostly we're talking about land that had already been won. And so the sons of Gad and Reuben again affirmed that their commitment to that plan will do just what was said, what we promised to, and so on. And Moses says he gave them the Amorite kingdom. Both Sihon and Og were kings in that area, and they'd already been conquered. And so they get the land and the cities and the ground that surrounds it. And then in verses 34 through 38, my best attempt at reading all those cities correctly, but we see all the sheepfolds that were established, that the cities that were fortified and made good for the tribes of Reuben and Gad, and they did that themselves. But we also then see why in those last few verses God also included one half of the tribe of Manasseh. The scriptures don't tell us why they got involved so directly, at least not in numbers. And they're included. And obviously, if you look at the map, Manasseh gets a lot of territory. They get a big chunk in the Promised Land, but they also get this big chunk north there. But they went out and conquered the remaining Amorites, two of the brothers, two men from the tribe of Manasseh. And so they were able to live there, and they took the land from the Amorites. And Moses formalized that conquering by giving them the land. Jer took towns, and Nobah took some towns and villages and renamed it Nobah. What do you know? And so this gives us an idea of what the bargain was for and who was involved. Questions, comments? All right. Well, let's go ahead then and look in Numbers 33, and we're going to start with the first 15 verses. We're not going to look at and read every verse out of this, but it is a kind of a look back. But let me begin in Numbers 33 and read 1 through 15. These are the journeys of the sons of Israel by which they came out of the land of Egypt, by their armies, under the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Moses recorded their starting places according to their journeys by the command of the Lord, and these are their journeys according to their starting places. They journeyed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the next day after the Passover. The sons of Israel started out boldly in the sight of all the Egyptians. While the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them, the Lord had also executed judgments on their gods. Then the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses and camped in Succoth. They journeyed from Succoth and camped in Etam, which is on the edge of the wilderness. They journeyed from Etam and turned back to Pi-Hahiroth, which faces Baal-Zephon, and they camped before Migdol. They journeyed from before Haroth and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness, and they went 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Etam and camped at Marah. They journeyed from Marah and came to Elim, and in Elim there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there. They journeyed from Elim and they camped by the Red Sea. They journeyed from the Red Sea and camped in the wilderness of Sin. They journeyed from the wilderness of Sin and camped at Dophkah. They journeyed from Dophkah and they camped at Elush. They journeyed from Elush and camped at Rephidim. Now it was there that the people had no water to drink. They journeyed from Rephidim and they camped in the wilderness of Sinai. They journeyed from the wilderness of Sinai and camped at Kibaroth Hattaavah. They journeyed from Kibaroth Hattaavah and camped at Hazeroth. They journeyed from Hazeroth and camped at Ritmah. They journeyed from Ritmah and camped at Rimmon Perez. They journeyed from Rimmon. I kept going. I'm going to stop. You get going, and there's just not a quick stopping point in there. But this is a chapter where, at God's direction, Moses records their travels and gives a few details along the way. Moses and Aaron were their leaders, and they came out of Egypt, it says, by their armies. And in verse 2, Moses recorded this regarding their starting places, but he also talked about where they ended, and then that becomes the new starting place, and so on. And they journeyed by the command of Yahweh. So how did Yahweh communicate his travel commands to them? What's that? Pillar of fire? Pillar of fire and pillar of cloud. How did they know when it was time to travel? When the pillar would lift up, and the way they would need to go to follow it and keep up with it. But that's not the only way. What was the other way? How did God direct the travel?
Through Moses.
Yeah, through Moses. There were times that God told Moses, okay, go to here, or go that way, or turn here. And so some of it was one way, and some of it was done with communication. And so it starts out with, in verse 4, from Ramses to Succoth. And that word Ramses being there creates some challenges from time to time, because when they left, it certainly wasn't called Ramses. Ramses, as a leader of Egypt, wouldn't have even existed at that point in time. Now, not everybody would agree with that statement, but from the things we looked at back when we were studying Exodus in the beginning parts, when we studied this departure, I think it's pretty clear that it wasn't a town called Ramses. This probably was put in there as an explanation or as the common name sometime after. But they left that area, and they says they did so. Verses 5 through 15 follows their track. But they did so in front of the soldiers, in front of the Egyptians. What made it easy for them to leave with all the Egyptians looking on?
They were busy burying their dead.
They had to stop and bury their firstborn. And so it says that that's what they were doing. It also says that Yahweh, the Lord, had also executed judgment against their gods. Do you remember how that was seen? How did the judgment against their gods occur? The plagues. With some plagues more than others, it's clear. We'll take one example, the Nile. The Nile to them was like a deity. The Nile was the source of life. The Nile was foundational to what they worshipped, what they did, where they saw provision come from. And so it was an area of worship. Well, what's one of the early plagues? We turned the Nile to blood. And it just keeps on going through the plagues like that. They had gods. One of them had a frog head. What was one of the plagues? Frogs. Where were the frogs? Oh my.
Except for the Jewish folks.
Yeah, except for, I believe that was one of the exceptions. That was the first exception, I think. I can't remember all the details, but I've slept more than once since then. But that was, a lot of these plagues had a very direct connection against their specific gods. And so God had devastated Egypt, showed their gods to be powerless, showed the Egyptians they were powerless if they had been paying attention, and gave them all their dead to bury. And with this great loss of life, how did the Egyptians send out the Israelites?
What kinds of goods?
Go fast. Take everything you want. Here, we'll deliver it. And what did the Egyptians voice as their concern if these people didn't leave? Do you remember that one?
Get out of here before we're dead.
Before we're all dead, go. They realized that to continue to hold what Moses had said many times, God's people back from leaving, was causing great death and destruction in their midst. And they were getting the point, it's escalating. So when you get to the death of the firstborn, it's obvious. There's another obvious piece to the death of the firstborn. What were the Israelites not needing to do before they left? bury their dead. They didn't have death and destruction at the night of the Passover, and certainly that had to be very visible to the Egyptians. Now, in verses 16 through 49, Moses recounts their travels over the 40 years from the time they left Egypt and up to the time they're getting ready to go into the Promised Land. And I'm not going to go back and read all that to you. I read a portion of it, but I will highlight a few locations that are mentioned in here because they're ones I could trace back. One reason I'm not going to go read it, and one reason that this passage is a bit challenging to put on a map, not a bit challenging, extremely difficult to put on a map, is many of these places, we don't know where they were. There's not even biblical history. The way that I worked my way through that was, I did it in the New American Standard, you might find some difference in a different version, maybe. Because one of the things that can happen is just like Ramses. In here, it was called Ramses. At the time they left, it was probably called Avaris. When it was first settled by Joseph, it was called, I got Gershon in my head, that's not quite right.
Goshen.
There, thank you. And so names change. And if you knew enough, you might be able to say, well, yeah, it's not Ramses. It's, at that time, it would have been Gershon. No.
Goshen.
I can't make that long O fit my word today. Goshen. And so I'm not saying these places aren't referenced somewhere, but in my background, it wasn't something that I could just readily go get. And didn't find other places. Most of the time, I would look at a commentary and they would say, well, most of these places, we don't know where they were. So I guess I chose to agree with them. But one of them is in verse 16. Kibroth Hattaavah. Find it mentioned in Numbers 11. And it's where the greedy ones were and wanted meat. And that's what Moses says here too. And so that's when the quail clan came. There was a big plague, and so that was a significant moment in the life of their travels. In the next one that I'll talk about is in verse 36, the wilderness of Zin and Kadesh. Kadesh in specific is mentioned in Numbers 13, because that's where they were when they sent the spies in to check out the Promised Land for the first time. And then it comes up again in Numbers 20 because Miriam dies there. The wilderness of Zin is also in verse 20, and Kadesh was probably on the edge of the wilderness of Zin, but this is where they had no water. And that's where there's a rebellion against Moses and Aaron that goes with this water. It's once again the people you brought us out here to die, and all of that comes up. And Moses isn't very happy, is he? This is where Moses sins. And instead of speaking to the rock, he speaks to the people. And he strikes the rock instead of speaking to it. And God still brings the water out of the rock. But he also brings the message to Moses, you're not going to be going into the Promised Land because you failed to show respect for my holiness in those moments. And then I want to read verses 37 through 39. And 37 through 39 says, they journeyed from Kadesh and camped at Mount Hor at the edge of the land of Edom. Then Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the sons of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt on the first day of the fifth month. Aaron was 123 years old when he died on Mount Hor. And so Mount Hor is mentioned elsewhere, of course, because Aaron does die, and it is mentioned when they're traveling around at that point. And he was 123 years old is an interesting fact to bring in here. And it was at the end or toward the end of their wanderings, It was 40 years after they had left Egypt. Verse 43 talks about Oboth. And in Numbers 21, this is where they camped after the serpents that came, and Moses' staff was lifted up with a bronze serpent on it as their healing point. Do you remember why the serpents came?
They were grumbling.
And why were they grumbling? You're right. That's a good answer. Well, I mean, seriously, that's... Yeah. So let's kind of go back to that a little bit. The king of Arad was in the Negev area, which is south end west of the bottom of the Dead Sea over here, kind of over south of the area where it says Simon and his group, that the Simeon settled as a tribe. And that king fought with Israel and took captives. And Israel made a vow to Yahweh, interesting words, based on our talk about vows a while back. And they said, if you will deliver this people to us, meaning let us conquer them, then we will destroy their cities while we're there. And so Yahweh did that at Hormah, which is not mentioned here in this chapter. But they find themselves in going, after that moment, they go around Edom at God's direction, because they're not to bother the people of Edom. God said, I promised this, and we won't bother the Edomites. And the people rebelled because it's a long trip, and we don't have, their words are that we have no water and no food, and we hate this food. You remember that?
Yeah.
They say we don't have any water and food, yet they had the manna, but they'd grown tired of it. And so then that's the reason then that God punished them, and where they camped was Oboth after the serpents. And then we'll talk about verse 44 has Liabirim in it. And in Numbers 21, that's where they went after they left Oboth. And then in Numbers 27, they also were at Mount Abiram, and that's where God sends Moses up to see the promised land that he's not going to be entering. And then in verses 45 through 49, we really get into very near time for this group, because in verses 45 to 49, we're seeing the travels that they did through the Amorite conquest and their camping on the plains of Moab. And so Moses recounts all of this. Why would this be important for this group of people to receive this historical account?
Confidence in what God has done over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, why wouldn't they have that anyway?
The generation that experienced the early events had passed away in the wilderness, and so it's really just recounting the faithfulness of God for a new generation who weren't there to see.
Who's alive that actually lived through this?
Moses,
Joshua, and Caleb. Yeah. And yet, we've got 600,000 warriors plus, 600,000 plus warriors. They've got a big nation. And to varying degrees, the history of our nation is studied in our school systems, right? And probably when some of us, at least at my age, were younger, it was a very significant study. It really defined who we were. It really showed us the influence, and there was no bones made about it, of these Christian men that came here because they were oppressed for their beliefs and what they considered truthful doctrine out of the scriptures across the Atlantic. And it showed they established some things about freedom of speech, freedom of religion, how men were given by God certain unalienable rights. They gave God was the source of, I mean, this was very clear throughout our American history studies. I don't know for sure how strong of believers my teachers were, but they sure taught it just like it was in the book. And this was important to our identity as a nation. I don't know what's going on for sure today. It seems like maybe that's become weak. That's not my point here. My point here is these people are about to conquer a land and they need this foundation. Without this foundation, they'll only have their own experiences with God, and I shouldn't put an only in front of that, because they're going to have magnificent experiences with God leading them into this nation. They've already had some, but they don't have all of this history clear back to being slaves in Egypt. There isn't a person left, so to speak, there are three, that knew what it was like to live under slavery in Egypt. There isn't a person left that saw the plagues. There isn't a person left that saw how God moved them out. There isn't a person left that saw how God provided them with all this substance from the Egyptians. There isn't a person left that saw how God separated the Red Sea and wiped out the Egyptian army without them having to lift a finger, except walk across the water, where dry ground really is now, but it would have been water moments before. Questions, comments? I don't think we can underestimate how important this chapter was for the birthing foundational piece of what God's going to do in the Promised Land. Let's go on. Let's look at verses 50 through 56 of Numbers 33. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their molten images and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land and live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. You shall inherit the land by lot according to your families. To the larger you shall give more inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give less inheritance. Wherever the lot falls to anyone, that shall be his. You shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eyes and as thorns in your sides, and they will trouble you in the land which you live. And I, as I plan to do to them, so I will do to you." So God gives instructions to Moses to pass on to the people. And God says, tell Israel, tell these tribes, as they're getting ready to cross the Jordan, here's your instructions. And what were the instructions? What were they supposed to do? Drive out anybody living there. When they got done, of the original inhabitants, who should be living in the lands that God's giving them besides Israelites?
Nobody.
Nobody. But it doesn't just stop there. What else are they to do with regard to the things these people are leaving behind or are now using? Destroy what? Really, is that what it says in your version? Molten images?
Figured stones.
And high places. So what are the figured stones? Idols. Molten images. Idols. So if they've made an idol and carved it out of stone or a molten image, it's got to go. Destroy it. What might some of these molten images be made out of?
Gold.
Gold, yeah. That was a pretty common thing for molten images in this era. Gold was pretty easy to work with comparatively. And then get rid of their high places. What are high places? Yeah, areas of worship. They might have had altars for sacrifice. They might have had an idol set up there. It might have just been a family heritage thing. But nonetheless, these high places, they would tend to elevate them. They would either maybe make a mound, or they might go out to a high hill that already exists and put a worship area there. That was pretty common in this era, to somehow try to see that place of worship lifted up, even if it was just a bit. Sometimes it was a lot. What commandment does this go back to? What recent behavior does this go back to? Well, that's not as recent. That's 40 years ago now. I'm a little more recent than that. But it's a good answer. What?
Baal worship at Peor.
Baal worship at Peor. How did they get involved in their sin at Peor? They started to mix it up with who? The inhabitants. The Moabites and the Midianites. Yeah, that they went down and destroyed later. And as soon as they did, they started interacting with them socially. What did they do? And the scriptures are quite clear. They began to go with these people as they worshiped their gods. Yes, there was the harlotry sin, but look how quickly they had begun to worship Baal. Just out of social, hey, we're going to worship. Why don't you come along? They want to be friendly, so they go along. There's some lessons for that for some of us. I don't mean some of us necessarily in this room, but it's not a friendly thing to go to some other worship of some other god to try to make a relationship with that person. That's just not the right way to go at it. You'll have a better testimony and witness if you say, I can't. I can't worship another god. I'm sorry. I mean, I don't want to make you mad. Maybe I do. Maybe I don't care. But nonetheless, I can't do that. Verse 53, he gives them a command. Possess the land, live in it. Why is that a reasonable thing for them to do? He says it right there in the verse. Verse 53. God himself has given you this land. It's yours as a people. And then the specifics we'll deal with in a little bit later. Matter of fact, this verse 54. You will inherit the land by lot according to your families. The bigger your family, the bigger your space. This could raise a question or two. Was it by individual families within a tribe, or is the tribe the family talked about here? I don't know, but certainly the bigger tribes got more space. And how is it done? It's done by lot. What's the lot? You remember what the lot is? Is it by chance?
Something with the priest, wasn't
it? Absolutely not by chance. No, the lot was something that the priest was part of his uniform that he would use as decision-making from God. So God's going to, by lot, reveal to you where you're going to be. Verse 55, he gives them a warning. What's the warning?
If you don't get rid of them, they're going to be a thorn.
Yes, and he's pretty specific. One of the ways he described it is they will be pricks in your eyes. Going out and looking at that word for pricks, it's like thorns or splinters. You're going to have sharp things sticking in your eyes. That sound real pleasant? Not that they're literally going to have that, but it's going to be of the same nature of frustration for them to have these things part of their lives and thorns in your sides. It's going to be a little bit like falling into the long pointed rose bush. Sound like fun? Oh, but it gets worse. Look at this verse 56. And what I plan to do to them, if you don't wipe them out, I'm going to do it to you. And so God is very clear. When you reach the time that you're there to take the land, you're there to do just what I said, take the land. Leave nobody else there. If you do, you will regret it. Because you will be taking me on as an enemy, and there will be plenty of unpleasantness just having them around. I want to think about, for a moment with you, this chapter 33. as a heritage. Anybody in here Jewish descent? I'm not trying to pick on anybody or anything, but anybody? Oh, so we don't have this to point back to, do we? But we as Christians lack no heritage. We should have every thought about every foundation of what it means for us to be believers in this day and age. It isn't just this day and age. As a matter of fact, the heritage that the Jews had is part of our heritage, right? The New Testament says we are even now children of the promise, meaning children of the promise made to Abraham. And what was the promise made? Through your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. What's the blessing? Well, it starts with the person of Jesus Christ. There is plenty of history, both in and even out of Christendom, for us to look back to and see the attributes of God. His power, His omniscience, He can see all things. Omnipotence is power, do all things. We can see that as we read in Romans 9, God has a purpose, and that purpose will not be defeated. He says in chapter 9, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated, not because of anything they had do or would do, but so that my purposes would be fulfilled. And if we think our heritage is mostly focused on recent days and what is it going on today, we ought to read Ephesians 1 verse 3. When was your name written in the Lamb's Book of Life before the very foundations of the world? And we can't know those things, we can't incorporate them into our lives with fullness until we become students of the Word God has given us. I'm not trying to make a big case for studying the Old Testament, but in my own personal life in the church, I have mostly taught and focused on the New Testament, but it's been very revealing to me to focus here on the Old Testament. I'm not as good at it because I don't have as much pre-existing background in it, so I have to work harder, and that's fine. And I only get as far as I get, and that's maybe not so fine. But nonetheless, we get to see God in action here, but as we look forward, God is in action through all of the Old Testament, God is in action through the New Testament, and God is in action that in that, if you are born again and believe in Jesus Christ, believe in His fulfilling work on the cross of substitutionary taking your punishment for you, and that He was raised from the dead, and you are born again, that is an act of God in today's world. And it is not just something that came up today. It's something He planned before the world ever started. And the path we're looking at in Numbers and Exodus and Genesis looked forward to that plan. And He is still looking forward to the plans He has made for you for eternity, day by day by day. And we have a tremendous heritage. And yet, it's become popular to dilute what it means to be a Christian in today's world. I'm not going to call them Christians, but there are many people that take the name of Christ that will say things like, well, your God's as good as my God. You know, whatever God's God for you, that works for you. Oh, and, you know, well, yeah, that used to be considered a sin, but in culture today, that's, you know, that's really not a sin anymore. I don't think God changes. And we need to be careful that we live in accordance with our heritage. If we don't, we're going to have the equivalent of pricks in our eyes and thorns in our sides because of the compromises that we become a part of. Questions, comments, thoughts? Okay. I want to make a start into Numbers chapter 34. And as we do so, I didn't know if we'd get here or not, but I do want to do that. I think it fits. But I've got another handout. So I'm going to divide this in two and say, take one and pass it around. And we're going to look at the colored side first, probably. But Numbers chapter 34, 1 through 12. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land of Canaan, this is the land that shall fall to you as an inheritance, even the land of Canaan according to its borders. Your southern sector shall extend from the wilderness of Zin along the side of Edom, and your southern border shall extend from the end of the Salt Sea eastward. Then your border shall turn direction from the south to the ascent of Akribim and continue to Zin, and its termination shall be to the south of Kadesh Barnea, and it shall reach Hazaradar and continue to Asmon. The border shall turn direction from Asmon to the brook of Egypt, and its termination shall be at the sea. As for the western border, you shall have the Great Sea, that is, its coastline. This shall be your west border. And this shall be your north border. You shall draw your border line from the Great Sea to Mount Hor. You shall draw a line from Mount Hor to Lebo Hamath, and the termination of the border shall be at Zedad. And the border shall proceed to Ziphron, and its termination shall be at Haz Anan. And this shall be your north border. For your eastern border, you shall also draw a line from Hazanane to Shepham. And the border shall go down from Shepham to Riblah on the east side of Ain. And the border shall go down and reach to the slope on the east side of the sea of Chinnereth. And the border shall go down to the Jordan, and its termination shall be the Salt Sea. This shall be your land according to its borders all around. So probably don't need to say much. That was fairly explanatory, right? Did you get all that? Well, don't feel alone. There's a lot of people that don't get all that. Some of them are even scholarly people. And so I started looking for and found people that would claim they knew where all these things were. And yet they would put, like, on our map I gave you up there at the top on the northern border, they renamed Mount Hor to Mount Hor ? So some of these things aren't sure to very many people. And I also was a bit troubled by the fact that we have 2.5 tribes east of the Jordan. But I came to a pretty strong conclusion that in this text, and MacArthur Study Bible started me down this direction, those items east of the Jordan are not part of, quote, the promised land mentioned in this particular passage. From what I could put together and looking for consensus and a few other things, this map I brought to you is about the best I thought I found. Do I think they got every line right? No, probably not. There's a lot of these towns, we don't know where they were. And when they starting up the slope of, okay, that's really an interesting location to talk about. So some of it was probably very clear in their day that they knew exactly where God was talking about, but that hasn't been transmitted to us today. There's one thing I just want to point out in spades. I became angry as I searched the maps. One of the things that made me angry was there is one part of what God says here that's absolutely clear. What's the western border of Israel?
Mediterranean.
The Mediterranean Sea. Over half of the maps that I looked at, some from places that I like to use because they've consistently been very scriptural, carve out Gaza. and don't show it as part of what God promised. Now, where do you think that came from? Isn't that something? Why would these... Yes, Dave?
That comes from unbelief.
That's exactly right.
Unbelief.
Absolute unbelief. And wanting to not offend somebody. Hey, you know, offending somebody is not our problem. I mean, it will be. We might be the face they see when they get offended, and they may take it out on me. But I really didn't offend them. God did. And the last thing I want to do is not offend them by agreeing with them, because now who's God going to be offended with?
You.
Me. So if we're going to talk about where the lines were according to scriptures here in Numbers, it included Gaza, okay? So the one I'm most sure of is the one that over half the maps I looked at, from what I would have previously said were very conservative sources, didn't include Gaza. Okay, enough of that. I got that out of my system, maybe. But I also want to take you a couple other places. And the first place I want to take you is Genesis 15, 18 to 21. Genesis 15, 18 through 21. And so this is God talking to Abraham. Look at your notes, make sure you got the right one. Yes, this is right after the formal covenant. The animals have been split, and God walks down between them, look like a fiery oven. And so this is a formal institutionalization or a creating of the Abrahamic covenant from God. And so let's look at 18 to 21. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, "To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite, and the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and all the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite." If you turn this over, and this wouldn't be the only representation of it, but this is one representation of what is believed God covered in the lighter shaded area in the words in Genesis 15. And yet, what he covers in Numbers is a much more limited area. So what does that mean? Well, that can mean a number of things. One is, God made promises to Abraham, right? Can we be certain God will fulfill his promises to Abraham?
Amen.
And one of his promises was that he would bless all the nations through his seed. We know that means Christ, right? God also made promises to David. What was one of his promises to David?
He'll establish his throne forever.
Has that happened yet?
Yes.
Well, it's established, but do we see it in existence on earth today?
No.
So, not to slice that, but I'm talking about what we see done on earth today at this point. And we would look to the millennial reign of Christ as the time that's going to be truly initiated for all men everywhere. And so one of the explanations, and I'm not saying this is the explanation, but when God sent these tribes over across the Jordan, and remember there's only 9.5 of the tribes are going to actually be in that area described, because he doesn't talk about east of the Jordan, in this, which is the dark area here, or close to it. One of the things that I find fascinating when I look at Genesis 15 is he lists some people. The Kenanite, the Kezanite, the Kadmonite, and I could keep reading, but I'll go down to verse 21, and the Amorite. Where did Gad and Reuben and half of Manasseh wind up in the Amorite land. So it may not have been specifically mentioned by God in chapter 33, but it was specifically mentioned in Genesis. So there's more to the story of what God promised Abraham for a land space than what he was specifically directing them into in this initial conquest. The same guy that drew this up, somebody borrowed it from him and put it out there, and I stole it from them. Not literally stole it. For educational purposes, this is entirely legal. I've been around this at the college. But the guy that originally drew this said that he believed that that if the Israelites, and when you put "if" in front of something with God, you start going sideways generally. But this is how he said it. If the Israelites had been faithful and done all that he'd expected them, he would have expanded them to be all of this land. I don't think that's true. But I think it's an interesting way to think about it. And it may even be that in the days yet to come, we're going to see Israel occupy all that land. Because many of these prophecies and promises are not fulfilled in just one situation, but it takes multiple situations over time before you get them all. I'm not going to make a hard case for that. I'm just saying, here's a possibility. I'm not going to take the time to turn you there, but in Genesis 17, 18, God said, "I'm going to give you all the land of Canaan." Well, what's all the land of Canaan? That sounds like the area that he just sent them into in Numbers 33, 34. Numbers 33. But so it's just interesting that part of the time God is talking to Abraham. He's talking about a bigger area. Part of the time he's talking about the land of Canaan. Which, what were the borders at the moment he said it? I don't know. But I'll bet you it comes pretty close to where God sent the Israelites here in the book of Numbers. Okay. That's probably enough for the moment. Questions, comments? Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, just during the time of King David and King Solomon,
mm-hmm.
the largest expanse of territory that the nation was occupied, which is a very large area. But even then, they did not conquer the entire area that was promised to Joshua.
Yep. Of course, in the millennium, where's Christ's borders going to be ultimately? Won't be any. But yeah, and his headquarters will be the promised land, and his throne's going to be in Jerusalem. I have no doubt about that. But yeah, we've got great things to come. And I didn't make it clear to the river Euphrates, and that's part of what they can say pretty surely, even in the times of Solomon and David. Well, thanks. We'll keep going with this, and we'll pick it up next week somewhere in there. Probably start with verse 13.